Welcome to the Valley College Connection, where John Kawhi and Scott Wigan, two Valley professors, engage in a conversation about success with educators and students. Each week, they'll sit down with a different guest to find out ways each of us have had to plan, persevere, and overcome to where we are now. The show will also highlight resources and services that are working to make a difference at Valley College.
We are joined today by Chauncey Madron, Academic Senate President and Associate Professor of Music at Los Angeles Valley College. Thank you so much for joining us, Chauncey.
You're welcome. It's good to be with you.
We've been wanting to chat with you for a while, so I'm glad that we were able to find the time to all sit down here together. Chauncey, if you could take us back and tell us about the pathway that ultimately brought you to Valley College and where you're at now. And I'd like to invite you and encourage you to take it as far back as you'd like.
Okay.
You can start in elementary school, you can start in high school, you can start while at Valley College, but the more we get to hear about your story, the better.
Well, I'll start with Valley College because that does go back a ways, actually. I started taking classes at Valley College in the early 1980s. And at that time, when I first came to Valley College, I had decided to major in foreign languages, not music, even though I had studied music all through high school. And I did that because I did not want to study something. My experience had been that if I studied something, they would make me hate it. So I didn't want to do that. So I decided to major in foreign languages. But as I was doing that, I was also taking various classes in music. And I was taking piano classes. And a former faculty member of the music department at Valley, David Carroll, was just such a great teacher and really fascinating, both in terms of teaching piano, but introducing the theory into the piano classes, that I just thought, okay, I've just got to study music. So that's I changed my major about a year later and started taking a full-time music load.
Let me ask you a quick question here to bring it back a little bit further.
Sure.
I know you said you wanted to start at Valley, but so, you know, coming to Valley College in the first place, are you local to the San Fernando Valley? Were you interested in music in high school? Like, how'd you end up at Valley?
Oh yeah, well, I'm a Southern California boy all the way. I mean, I was born and raised here. I was born in the California Hospital in downtown Los Angeles, but my parents lived in Burbank. So I went to Burbank schools all my life. And it was in fourth grade that I first started taking trumpet. That was my first instrument. And then in junior high, it was kind of interesting. I went through a really weird period where I didn't want to do music anymore. I thought it was the most corrupt, decadent art form that you could imagine, and I wasn't going to have anything to do with it.
Well, what inspired those thoughts?
I think I got into a kind of utilitarian, you know, everything must be useful, everything must have a purpose, and art just didn't have a purpose, at least in my mind then. Now I understand it differently, but I think in my mind then, I didn't see art as having a productive purpose.
And
so
when
I didn't think it would work.
When you were playing trumpet, was this something that your parents started with private lessons, or did it start with school?
No, it started with school, and I actually kind of had to beg them to let me do it. Although I'm one of seven kids, and everybody in my family at one time or another had played an instrument, you know, had studied an instrument. I'm the only one who ended up being a musician of any note, but everybody did something with music. But when it came around to me, I think my parents were just kind of done with the idea of trying to get anybody to practice anymore, you know. So, but I had to kind of like really keep after them to get me a trumpet. And money was kind of tight too. So that was also an issue.
Did you play trumpet up through high school as well? Or did you switch instruments at some point?
I played trumpet up through junior high. And even through junior high, I was still fooling around with it. But I sort of dropped out. And then in high school, or even before, a little before high school, that's when I started listening to Dixieland jazz. For some reason, I just got into that. And when I started doing that, I just loved the clarinet. You know, the clarinet just sort of cuts through the texture and is, I think, sort of the star of that kind of thing. So I'm like, okay, I got to play clarinet. And so I bugged my parents, my mom, to get me a clarinet. and finally got that, you know, going. And that was really, then it really caught fire with me through high school, both because I really wanted to do it. And so I was practicing a lot all through high school. I had friends who were interested in music and who wanted to talk about music. So we were talking about Stravinsky and John Cage and Beethoven and just whatever else we could, you know, come up with. And so it was great to have people who were around me who were interested in the same things as I was. I hadn't really had that experience with music prior to that.
So at that time, you were more into classical and Dixieland jazz, or, I mean, it's quite a spectrum.
Yeah, I've always been through the spectrum. Yeah, I was at that time, well, Dixieland jazz was my entree, but classical music was still a love. And actually in later high school, I fell in love with like rock and roll, but not necessarily 50s rock. It was more of a 60s flavored tinge. I mean, I was born in 61, so I didn't really experience the 60s as somebody who could have gone to Woodstock, let's say, or something like that. But I really wish I had, because that kind of music, the Grateful Dead, Bob Dylan, the band, those were just some of my favorites. I really admire them. So in kind of my later high school career, in addition to the clarinet, I picked up the guitar to learn how to play guitar.
What did practice look like for you back then? So you said that you were practicing, you know, with the clarinet, you know, is that half hour a day, an hour a day, 2 hours a day?
I would come home from school about 3:30, have a snack, and then probably spend the rest of the day practicing various between, you know, like I'd spend a couple hours on clarinet. I'd spend probably a couple hours on guitar. And I also would spend some time on piano as well. Although not quite as much until I started college. You know, when you start a college music program, piano is kind of a requisite for studying theory. And so I really got into piano after that too. Then it was kind of like I come home and I spend a couple few hours playing piano, and then I go to clarinet in the evening, you know. But it was, a break for dinner and then back into practicing.
At that time, did you feel talented? Because, I mean, it's not usual for a high school student to be able to just sort of naturally pick up these instruments.
No, you know, I want to say I don't really believe in talent. That's not quite the case, but I really think a lot of what musical mastery about is hard work. You know, it's just picking up something and dedicating yourself to it and really making it work. Recognizing that there are some people who can pick up an instrument and start playing it fabulously from the very beginning, but that's not me. So no, I think I have a talent for thinking the way music thinks. You know, music is very linear and progresses along in a kind of very logical fashion. And so I always appreciated that, you know, that kind of logical progression. And so whether it's looking at the theory of, you know, the structure of a piece and the way the theory works out, or playing it and realizing that as you play it, that process intrigued me all the time.
So thank you for stepping back a little bit further and providing some more context about your interest in music, you know, before coming to Valley College. So, you know, there you are in high school and you're, you know, a multi-instrumentalist at that point and obviously heavily into music. Yeah. So at the point when you graduate high school and you're living in Burbank, what was it that brought you to Valley College? Was it, you know, the local college and that's the next step, or what was the decision there?
I hate to say it, but yeah, it was pretty much, you know, like that's the closest thing. So might as well go for it. I mean, there's a little bit more to it than that. I did take a year off after high school. I think I was still trying to figure out what the hell I was going to do. You know, I mentioned before I was getting into guitar, and I actually had a small band with, you know, my brother and a friend of his. We were working on stuff then, and, you know, but I don't think I really knew that college or music was my path, you know what I'm saying? So I didn't go to Valley College right away, but after about a year of that, my dad was like, you got to go to school, you got to pick something, do something, you know. And so since Valley College was close by, that was kind of a natural choice. But I also have to say, like, at that time I wasn't driving still. I didn't get my driver's license till I was like 20. And so bicycling was the way to go. And so I couldn't really well bicycle to Cal State LA or Northridge. I mean, I could have, but you know, that would have been a, but Valley College was like an 8 mile bike ride. So it was doable. And so that was part of the decision too.
And then how did you come to start with foreign languages?
Well, I think, you know, in high school, I also took foreign languages. I took French, I actually started French in middle school, in junior high. They had a French program there too. And so I'd been taking French, but I think the two are connected in that they both require the ear, right? The sensitivity of the ear. But I think music is very much another language. It's just a very abstract language, but it's a language in which you can put thoughts and ideas and express feelings. And so I see the two as being related, and they both have their grammar, their vocabularies, their grammars, their structures. So I think the language thing was just kind of a side path while I figured out what I was doing, but I think they are related. It's not like I was, what would be really different? I thought I was a math major or anything.
Sure. So then you went to Valley, you met this really wonderful teacher who introduced you to piano. And then what happened after that?
Well, so when I started majoring in music, music majors are, I would say in some ways are very cloistered, you know, because they get into, like I had an 8 o'clock theory class Monday through Friday. After that, I would end up in, you know, a piano class, let's say, an appreciation class. I would practice a lot there at Valley College because it was a lot easier on everybody around me if I was using the practice rooms rather than practicing at home. And then there's also a kind of like, you get into this thing where, again, if music is a language, you want to hang out with the people who speak your language, you know? So when you're saying, yeah, did you like that C major 7 chord or that 5 of 5 chord, you know, they understand what you're saying, whereas other people don't, you know? So you kind of end up hanging out there. And so I would do that and then go take my one math class, go take my one history class. You know, every semester I probably had one or two other classes, but for the most part, I was kind of ensconced in the music department. So I really felt like that was home. And I even see that today with our students who are studying music. They kind of use the music building as their base of operations. And then they go out to the college at large, but the music department's kind of home, you know.
So at this point, were you planning on becoming a performer, or were you always thinking about teaching? Or
I wanted to be a composer, actually. That was my start off, or that was my goal in starting to study music theory, was to do composition. But I have to say, so watching the Valley College faculty teach me made me want to do that. And I remember saying to myself, I want to do that. You know, I want to do what they do. I had no idea how long that journey would be or how I would get there. But I remember thinking that there's so many great music faculty. I mentioned David Carroll, but Ted Lynn was a big influence on me. Dick Carlson, Kathy Adams, Don Nelligan. These were all like, it still is a great department. It was a lot bigger than, but just some really caring faculty, but who also wanted to teach you music. They were, you know, it was pretty a rigorous education, but they were always willing to help you. So I like, that's why I want to do that. I want to take somebody who doesn't know anything about music theory and help them, you know? And so that's kind of what that was like. You know?
So, and in terms of time frame, are we talking, is this like 1980, 1981?
I think I was there like 81 through 85.
Okay.
I think that's about right. It's kind of blurry for me because I did transfer to CSUN after about, you know, 3 or 4 years at Valley. But at the same time, I still came back to Valley and played in the wind ensemble. I sang in the choirs, both because they needed me and because it was good practice, right? So to play in the wind ensemble on Monday nights was just good reading practice for me. I just read a whole bunch of music that way. And the same is true of the choirs. Like I'm not a singer by, you know, specialization, but to sing music helps really develop the ear. It's a very important factor in developing that kind of inner ear that you have to be able to look at a piece of music and hear it in your head. And so I pursued both of those things. Even while I was going to Northridge and taking whatever classes I was taking over there, that was, you know, what would I say? That was part of my education. So it's kind of blurry. The line between Valley and CSUN blurs during that mid-80s period.
Did you transfer to CSUN as a you know, junior standing, you know, music major or in two years at CSUN?
Junior standing music major, yeah.
Okay.
And how was your experience at CSUN?
It was good. It was the only thing that was really disorienting was that it was a much bigger department. You know, so at Valley, I was the clarinet player. At CSUN, I was not only not the clarinet player, I was one of, you know, a couple dozen. But still, it was a good experience because I, you know, to experience that larger world, you know, to go from being a big fish in a little pond to a little fish in a big pond and understand how competitive music is as an art form and performance and how then I was really working hard.
And as you were working your way through the program then at CSUN, did you, you know, start to have your eye on this idea of teaching as inspired by the faculty at Valley, or were you, you know, still more interested
I was still working towards a master's degree because I knew that was the minimum quals to teach at, you know, a community college, but my specializations changed. So I went in wanting to study composition. If you don't know, music programs, they accept you as a certain specialization. So when I auditioned, I was actually accepted as a clarinet major. But composition, you have to do some composition writing first and then audition on composition. So I have to go show your compositions to a jury of composition faculty and whether they accept you or not. And I actually never was accepted as a composition major. So all the time I was at CSUN, I was ostensibly a clarinet major, but trying to become a composition major, but I never did. So that's, I graduated as a clarinet major performance. So it was a performance, even though I was taking electronic music composition, advanced theory classes to prepare for the comp major. I just never pulled that off.
I was just going to ask, so as you're finishing up, then your undergraduate at CSUN, did you do graduate school, the master's at CSUN as well, or did you go somewhere else for that?
No, I went to Riverside for that. It took me another 4 years at CSUN, so it was kind of like 90 when I graduated with my bachelor's. I took a long time for my bachelor's degree, you know, my undergraduate work.
And why was that, Chauncey? Were you working as well? Was it just the nature of the program being intensive and all the performance that was tied to it, or...?
It's both. Well, it's that and I would say another factor, which is kind of my fooling around, you know, like I mentioned, I started as a foreign language major. So I spent a year just kind of kicking around doing that. But even when I was at, let's say, CSUN, I would, you know, I mean, I was pursuing the major still, but I would maybe take courses that I didn't really need to take and were not part of my major. But so I spent some time maybe doing stuff I didn't really need, you know, didn't really need to do in terms of studying and taking classes, and spent my energies that way. And so I was kind of, don't want to say unfocused, but I was just, cause I knew where I was going and what I wanted to do, but I was never unwilling to take a class that maybe wouldn't, that I wanted to take, but maybe wouldn't lead to my degree. And then I was working at the same time. I was working at Valley College, actually, in the admissions and records office. And that was a part-time B-shift position. So that was another drain on my time. I mean, that actually did kind of make the evening practicing difficult, you know, and then going or going home and practicing after like 10 o'clock at night, which is also kind of hard. So that, I think all those things contributed to that, you know, this kind of diffuseness of purpose. And
how did you enjoy UC Riverside?
And why Riverside? What brought you out there?
Okay, yeah. So that's, so as I was at CSUN, in addition to clarinet performance and composition, I also got interested in music history. And at CSUN, they had a class they call a collegium, which is early music performance. And again, I just sort of got bitten by the early music performance bug. I was playing recorders and sackbuts and singing and all that kind of stuff. Again, taking classes that had nothing to do with my major goal, but I loved it. So Riverside had an early music performance practice degree. It was one of the first ones, you know, first bachelor's degrees in the area. That was still sort of a burgeoning field in music. So what that is they usually call it these days historically informed performance practice. In other words, playing Bach on the instruments that Bach originally wrote the music for. So let's say Bach, not on a piano, but on a harpsichord, mm-hmm. you know. But not only that, but with the style of Bach, studying the manuals that were written on the time on how to play the keyboard and finger them, you know, how, the type of dynamics, articulations that were used at that time. So it's a very much the idea of trying to perform the music as Bach would have heard it, let's say, or whoever, you know.
So where do you get the practice instruments? Did you buy a harpsichord and a recorder? And
no, well, recorders I bought. I still have some recorders. Okay. but harpsichords, no. Usually, you know, CSUN had a harpsichord. And also when I went to Riverside, they had not only a harpsichord, but a early piano forte. I don't know if that's a like an early version of the piano. So they had, you know, typically these programs that have these kind of, you know, early music performance programs, they loan instruments to students because they just won't, yeah, you won't have them unless you're really, really into it. You know, you won't have a sack butt unless you're really, really into early music performance. but some people do, you know. So that's how I, you know, I went to UC Riverside because they had this historical performance degree program, which I was really interested in.
That sounds so cool. So you get out there to Riverside, you start your master's program. Are you continuing to work at Valley College on the B shift while you're doing that?
No, I resigned my position at Valley College. I just could not see commuting. If you want to talk a little bit about commuting, when I finally had finished my degree and was looking for what to do next, like what, and I needed a job, you know, my wife and I couldn't survive in Riverside without income, you know. I actually started working back at Valley College doing registration again. And I was commuting from Riverside to Van Nuys every day to do that work. And that was the most nightmarish commute. I know people do that still. I don't understand how you could do that. That would drive me nuts.
What was that, 3 hours?
It was like 2 hours one way. Yeah. So like 4 hours a day. So
wow.
Yeah, that's a time. That's also, yeah, it's a huge time loss. You know, like you're not doing anything productive during that time. That was, you know, I did that just kind of as a way of connecting both Cindy and I back with Valley College so that we could both eventually come back here. You know, I mean, it's kind of an interim solution until we put all the pieces in place where I could get back here.
So for those who don't know you and don't know Cindy, you mentioned your wife and you've mentioned Cindy, but how can you tell us a little bit about that story?
Sure. So I met my wife, Cindy, of 30 almost years now at Valley College. When I was working in admissions and records, she was working in the disabled students programs and services. They called it DSPS back then. And so she would come in to get various things done for the students in that program. And we struck up a friendship that led to a dating relationship that led to a proposal and eventually marriage. and actually the marriage, I mean, we got married before I left to pursue my master's degree in Riverside. So Cindy came along with me. She got a job at Riverside Community College and I was doing a teaching assistantship. That was our income at Riverside. And then, as I said, when that teaching assistantship was over, I needed income. So I started working back at Valley College.
So what happened after Riverside?
Well, so I started working back at Valley in the admissions and records office. As soon as Cindy could find work back at Valley, she managed that. And so then we moved back we moved back in with my parents for just a little bit, just to kind of find our legs. And then we moved out to an apartment in North Hollywood. And so then we were working and supporting ourselves and that, you know, that whole sort of thing, both working at Valley College. And so I was working at admissions and records. I don't remember exactly, but I think at that time I got a full time position I got the part time position, but was also given additional like relief hours. So I was working a full-time salary at that time. And this was like the 93, 94, you know, about that time.
And were you teaching at all at this point?
Not at that point. That came a little later. So I was working in admissions and records. There was the instructional assistant in the music department at Valley was Joy Hunter. And she was about 94, she was retiring. And they were looking for somebody to replace her. And I appeared like a good candidate. I had both the music skills and background and degrees. And I also had the kind of general college knowledge about college procedures and policies and just a knowledge of the general college community. So I think I really looked like a strong candidate to them. So they asked me if I was interested and I was like, oh yeah, that's great. I'd love to work in the music department.
Were there still some faculty there from when you were a student teaching, or was it at that time new folks? Or
it was an interesting year because so when I got that job, one faculty member retired, had just retired the year before, but he was still around teaching part-time. It was Ted Linz. He was sort of a mentor of mine and very helpful to me. And then there were several retirements, one after the other. Maybe the district offered a retirement incentive. I don't quite remember, but there was a big flux of retirements at that time. And I think that worked in my favor because then they were looking for hourly, right? You know, people to take up those classes with hourly rate. And so this is where I think Ted stepped in, because I was never quite sure of this, but I'm pretty sure Ted twisted some arms to get me my first hourly rate fundamentals class and convinced them that I could do it, you know. And so that I started teaching, it was in 95 was my first hourly rate class.
And what was the scope of work of your instructional assistant position? So you're doing both. You're, you know, the IA in the music department and then teaching as well. But what was the role of the IA?
Well, the IA in the music department was largely a facilitator. One of their roles is to help monitor the various labs. So there's a practice room lab, there's a computer lab, there's a recording engineering studio. So to help kind of monitor the use of those, make sure it's all maintained, make sure that students are using it properly, make sure that students aren't fighting over practice rooms, you know, or doing inappropriate things in practice rooms. And then also I was doing things with the department budget, like purchasing. We were doing mailings at that time, like, you know, paper mailings. So I would do the bulk mailings. I'd prepare them, print the labels, sort them, get all that stuff ready. Just a whole bunch of different things. And a lot of the music faculty were dependent upon me to turn in grade changes, resolve add issues, because I could just walk into admissions and say, hey, you know, there's this problem going on, can we fix it? And everybody knew me there, so it was very easy for me to kind of resolve those problems that might be more difficult, you know, for faculty who aren't just familiar with the processes. So that was kind of my role as AA, as IA in the music department.
So when you started teaching, what was the first thing you taught and what was that first class like?
I taught music fundamentals, which is music 101. It's just a basic course in music theory. And I have to admit, it was, you know, you say, yeah, I want to do this. And you jump in and you think, I'm not prepared for this. Like, I had really no idea, you know, what I was supposed to do or how I was supposed to accomplish the goals of the course. So it was interesting the first time I got in front of a classroom, at least in that context. I had done that in my teaching assistantship, but I'd never really had control of a class myself, you know, and so I had to develop all the materials and homework and lectures, how to do all this stuff. But it came together, you know, I'm sure you all know how it is. You know, you teach one class and then plan for the next week and then teach that one and plan for the next one. And
oh yeah. My first class was a car crash. So, you know,
yeah. I think everybody feels
that. I'm not bragging to anybody on my first class.
But you know, I'll put this out to, you know, all of you, because I know you're all faculty. You say that like it was a car crash, but people come after you afterwards and go, that was a good class. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, they didn't know any better. But if you're a nice person, right? I have this thing where we talk to professors about, you know, like how to be a good speaker. And at the end, you know, we go through the rounds and we go like, okay, who was someone really meaningful to you? And then everyone names someone. And then we go, what was the thing that they taught you that was meaningful? And then everyone draws a blank. But what were they like? And they're like, they were really nice, or they encouraged me. Like, at the end of the day, no one's going to remember my math. But 5 years from now, they'll remember, he was pretty nice. I asked a question, he answered it, pretty friendly. They just didn't know that 5 years later, I could have answered in such a more intuitive way.
Well, you know, I see an analogy again with music in terms of, you know, teaching in front of a class and that experience, because how many times have I given a musical performance and thought, oh my God, I blew that measure. I played the wrong note. That's, you know, not the right chord. And you get off the stage and people start shaking your hand and going, great, I loved it. That was really wonderful. I was so moved. And you're thinking, what happened? Like, where were you? But I think it's just our own perceptions, right? You know, we're inside the performance. We're very much more critical of ourselves at the time that it's happening. And we don't realize how the overview that people see it, you know, afterwards.
I know that you were involved, I believe you were involved in the union as an instructional assistant, Chauncey. Is that true?
You mean the classified union?
Yes.
No, I was never in any union position in the classified union. My wife was the chapter chair at Valley College.
Ah, okay.
Union chapter chair. But I was never, I supported the union. I actually depended upon them to help me out sometimes, but I never had a position within the classified union.
Were you active on committees on campus?
I was. Yeah, okay. I really enjoyed that work. I know that sounds geeky or, you know, community college geeky or whatever, but as classified or part-time faculty, being on, I think the first committee was, I think they call it instructional planning or something like that. It was the same one as our EPC committee. You know, it was the educational planning committee, and they developed the mission statement and all that kind of stuff. But I thought the conversations about the school and its mission and its purpose were just so interesting. I really liked committees. So I've been on, you know, accreditation committees, enrollment management committees, educational planning committee. I can't even think of all of them, in addition to some other more statewide efforts in music, you know.
I feel that is the way to get connected to the school, because oftentimes people feel as if you have no say in things that happen, and you don't have a say until you join a committee and you're in a small room with people who actually make choices and actually listen to what you have to say.
Yeah.
And my recommendation always is that if you feel as if you're not being heard, join a committee.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's just the best way to feel heard and feel a part of the campus.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's, you know, as faculty, it's a requirement, but I would say even beyond that, you know, in terms of being part of the community, it's a really important function. You know, that's, you should just be there so you can be present and be part of the dialogues, you know. Yeah. And your input absolutely matters. I think I hope everybody could realize that.
So I'm sorry for the interruption there with that. John had asked you, when was the transition to your full-time teaching position?
Okay, so I was teaching one or two, mostly two classes from, you know, my first class in 95 until about, it was probably like 2010 or something like, even beyond that, because... the dates, they blur, but anyways, you know, I taught as an adjunct for many, many, many years in addition to working the full-time instructional assistant position. And I had always wanted to do the full-time thing. And in fact, I applied for full-time jobs at Valley and at other colleges during that time period, all the time I was teaching adjunct, but I was never selected. So I just kept pushing at it and pushing at it and pushing at it until, you know, an opening came up in our department. I applied for the position. I was interviewed. I went to the second interview with the president and was selected. And I nothing made me happier. Let me tell you, that was, and that relates back to my story earlier of watching, you know, music faculty when I was a student and going, I want to do that. When I became full-time faculty, it was such a rewarding thing for me to achieve, you know, what they had achieved and to be where they were. Cause I really admire, I still admire those people.
Well, what do you think was different in that last interview?
You're talking about the interview with,
for tenure, with the committee, or
with the president?
I guess with both. Like, what do you think was different in those conversations?
Well, I had a lot more experience. See, I'm also a, in fact, I've been on the executive board of an organization, the Music Association of California Community Colleges. And so through that organization, I got a chance again to be involved in statewide curriculum discussions, ADT, you know, things like ADTs and transfer model curriculum, repeatability. I was part of all of those and connected to all those. So I think that going into the interview, I was a much broader candidate. I wasn't just a music teacher, but I had, you know, statewide experience in terms of curriculum issues. I was connected to this organization called MAC. I had done various curriculum development work, you know, so I think I was just a much stronger candidate that last time, especially in terms of my broadness. So not, in other words, not just I can teach music theory or I know a lot about music theory, which is what the committee's concerned about, right? They want to see you can do stuff in music. Can you perform? Can you sing? Can you play? You know, but to the president, I think I represented somebody who would not just then just get into my job and just teach music, but I would work with the whole campus. You know, I would become a part of the whole campus.
I think a lot of times when I talk with adjuncts and they're trying to figure out how to break in, I usually tell them that the key thing is that, one, you have to be interesting. If you're not interesting, you won't get that second interview. But in that second interview, you have to know what the president is concerned about. What are the things that the president is what's she worried about? What are the issues that are going on nationally and statewide? And what are the policies happening? And if you could speak to those things that the president is worried about, then all of a sudden you have an in. But if you're going to go to the president, I'm not going to be able to talk math with the president. You're not going to be able to talk music with the president, but we can talk about, you know, state policy.
Yeah. No, I think it's,
yeah, that's the big thing.
I tell adjuncts the same thing. I mean, you got your discipline and you're great at what you do, you know, and you're very knowledgeable, but you need to be aware of the broader picture because a president is not just looking at that you teach English or math or music well. They have a much bigger picture and they want to know, you know, if you're going to move the college forward in terms of, you know, it could be facilities, it could be, you know, curriculum, it could be whatever, you know, I don't know, budget programs, you know, developing new programs. Those are all things that presidents are interested in, but you got to have that side of your resume as well. So, yeah.
And what a lot of adjuncts don't know is that the committees are open to everybody. And especially if you're an adjunct, they really encourage that voice to be within the room.
Mm-hmm.
So that you know, you have opportunity, you just sort of have to ask.
Yeah, I've talked to adjuncts about that, about committee participation. And their one concern is the time constraints, right? You know, they're maybe teaching in multiple colleges and it's hard for them to figure that piece of it out. But I just say, if you can, I recognize it's a stretch, but if you can, do some of that stuff, because it's really important to understand what the other issues are, what the college-wide issues are, not just what's going on in your discipline.
So how did your life change once you became tenured?
Well, once I was hired for the full-time position or became tenured itself?
I guess full-time position. I mean, the more money makes a big difference, but just also the more classes and the more responsibility.
The more classes was a really interesting thing because every class that I taught during that first year of full-time teaching, except for wind ensemble, I had taught before. But it was still hellaciously busy for me, you know? And so I wonder sometimes, you know, an adjunct who hasn't maybe taught all these things, who's hired for a full-time position, comes in and suddenly assigned five classes and has to prep for all five of them. Wow, you know, I don't even know how they do it, because I was still very, 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 very busy just prepping for classes, even though it was I had developed materials for most of them previously, you know. But I'm always tinkering with my classes. You know, if I develop three or four great exercises or materials to use in class, but then I'll turn around and go, but wait, I could do that this way. And then I'll just go off and spend hours developing something else. Yeah. So I'm never quite happy. You know, I don't think I'm ever going to get to the point where I'm like, oh, I could teach that class blindfolded, you know, or whatever. I just don't think that's a thing for me.
Yeah. I can understand that.
Chauncey, at what point then did you make this transition to the Academic Senate president?
That happened right. So in my year five of my tenure process, when I knew I was going to get tenure, because I'd already been through the fall review and, you know, the recommendation and, you know, you're heading towards tenure, that I knew that Josh was going to resign. I saw him in repro once and he was kind of joking, but he said, you know, anybody can run, you can run. And he pointed to me, you know, because of my involvement in, shared governance or participatory governance or whatever you want to call it. It actually, you know, I thought, yeah, I could run, you know, and it did intrigue me as another possible avenue. I do feel like, you know, in terms of faculty, we have two representational bodies, right? We have the union and we have the Senate. And I really do feel more at home in the Senate with things like curriculum and these kind of more, you know, professional development, these kind of maybe more amorphous issues that, you know, they're not about salaries or anything, but they really interest me in terms of advocating for faculty. So I threw my hat into the ring and was elected.
So I've never understood what is the relationship between the Academic Senate and I guess the school president? Like how do those things become adjudicated? How do you work together?
Well, so in Ed Code, the college president is supposed to consult collegially, that's the word, you know, the words used, with the faculty. And so, of course, the college president can't consult collegially with all the faculty. So most colleges develop an academic senate, or that's also in Ed Code, is the development of an academic senate as a representative body of the faculty to consult collegially with the president. And there's a list of issues called the 10 plus 1, which are things that are particularly supposed to be the purview for which we are supposed to be consulted collegially. Now, there's some things in which the college just automatically takes the word of the faculty, like curriculum. You know, they don't get in our way and say, well, no, you can't do that program. I mean, there's some negotiation that might go on in there, you know, in terms of developing a whole new program or a new course. But traditionally, if I say I'm going to offer this new course, the administration doesn't say, well, no, we don't want you to do that, you know. But there are some other things, like you could talk about something like student success is one of the 10 plus one. And that's where the college has to work together, right? There has to be a funding piece to that. There has to be a teaching piece to that. There has to be student support services. So that's where it gets more complicated, you know. But in all those things, the college administration is supposed to consult collegially with the faculty. And so that's where the Academic Senate comes in as a representative of the faculty on those 10 plus one matters.
Are you starting your third year as president now?
No, this is my second year as president.
This will be your second year. Okay, yeah. So how are you enjoying it?
I'm both enjoying it and daunted by it, you know. I think daunted in terms of the number of things that need to be done. That's one issue. And then also the number of things I need to learn about, you know, and understand completely in order to navigate all the discussions about these different things, you know, like budget, that's a huge one. Even though, again, the Senate really doesn't have any control over the college budget, but we can ask questions about it, you know. And so how do you understand how budgeting works and how the Senate can fit itself into that discussion? That's a you know, something we all got to figure out. So I think those are kind of two daunting things, but I really enjoy it. You know, I mean, I'm very passionate about my advocacy for faculty. I in fact, well, we'll see. Can we discuss controversial issues in this?
Sure, absolutely. It's better if you do.
That's the good stuff.
Well, I'll tell you, I think this has been an issue since I first started teaching as an adjunct. I've always kind of felt as if the college administration feels as if they need to control us, or, you know, control us is the thing. They need to kind of keep us down, but they need to make sure we don't go crazy, because the way they see faculty is just, you know, like if they didn't discipline us, we'd be all over the place, you know? And I really think the attitude of administration should be, how can we help you? You know, you're in the classroom, you're teaching a group of students a certain subject, and you know best how to get that teaching done. I strongly, firmly believe that the faculty in the classroom know what needs to be done with the students. So the administration's attitude should be, how can we support that? You know, how do we help you do that? What equipment do you need? What tutoring, teaching materials, what is it that you need? What can we help you with? Rather than, well, no, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. You know? So it's not that I want them to maybe even conduct business any differently than they do now. I just think it's an attitude that I wish would change.
I mean, when we've interviewed people who've been around for a long time, there is a conversation where it feels like the administration sometimes is not on the side of faculty. And that is something that we've noticed in a lot of our podcast interviews in the past, that it did seem like the relationship has changed. Although I will say that two presidents ago, I remember Scott and I went to the Academic Senate. This was my first introduction to the Academic Senate. And there was a real heated argument about the president not even meeting with the Academic Senate president. And I remember listening to all of this, of them saying that they don't listen to us. And then Scott and I went up there and said, we'd like you to support us for tutoring. And we go, great. And I go, I don't know what that did after 2 hours of listening to them tell us, like, president doesn't listen to us, you know. But I haven't heard it seems like it's much better within the last 10 years that I've been here, that there has been some healing process from, I guess, a pretty rough patch we had a few years ago.
Yeah, I think it's just really I think it's a change of focus or attitude, that there's a culture of this, you know, I've worked with colleagues at other colleges, I see how they work, and I feel like, why can't we do that? You know, really, your president supports your marching band and your choir and your, you know, why can't ours do that? You know, that's kind of, it's sort of a feeling I get, you know, I think you're right. I think some things have improved more recently, and so I'm happy. I'm always optimistic, you know. I'm never like, sure, done. I'm checking out. I'm finished. You know?
I think your history and everything that you've done at the college to date, you know, substantiates that you're an optimist, and that you continue to be involved in the work and advocating for faculty and for students. And you know, I think as we've seen over time too, that the more that we can, you know, move towards a language where, or even, you know, getting away from administration, being this or that, and starting to talk about individuals. Not that I'm advocating we talk about any individuals here now, but just that sort of idea in general, that there are so many administrators who are very faculty-centered and supportive, and student-centered and supportive, who do get what you're saying. There's those who don't, just as there are faculty who are student-centered and supportive and those who aren't. There's the district. And as you were describing that, it made me think of the district. At times I feel like, oh, the district's been an obstacle, but it's not necessarily the district. There's amazing people at the district, and then there's people at the district who are not.
Yeah.
So it ends up becoming this sort of, you know, language of nuance.
Well, I will say, you know, when you mentioned working in a district, again, to go back to the fact that I've worked with other colleagues at other colleges, and some of them from single college districts, that's a different experience. I know that for a fact. You know, working in a district is just a whole nother level of bureaucracy and administration that is sometimes really hard to navigate, you know, and that's an experience I've had as a classified, as a part-time faculty member, as a full-time faculty member, it's just always been that way. It's not that, and I'm always willing to work within the structures. I'm totally on board with that. I'm part of a large district. There's going to be bureaucracy. I'm okay with that. But sometimes it gets a little draining.
It does. And again, the fact that you've been involved with so much work for so long, and here you are starting your next term as Senate president and the craziest of times, as we're going through here. One of my last questions here is we perhaps, wrap up this first interview with you, Chauncey, and it feels like we've kind of scratched the surface. So I would hope that we'd be able to continue the conversation again. But, one of my last questions is, what are you looking forward to for this next year here?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think my goals for the Senate are kind of small, but I think about things like rewriting the bylaws and, discussing the budgeting of the Senate, maybe getting more faculty to pay their Senate dues so that we have a little more money to work with. But also maintaining the quality of our instructional programs and advocating for faculty on various issues that have come up during the pandemic. There's been a lot of, because of the switch to online education, that's been a big transition for a lot of people, right? Including myself, as a music teacher, although I had used Canvas for some time, I would always just wanted to be face-to-face because I felt that music was better done face-to-face. It's a performance art. But I had to make that transition. And so it was difficult. And so how can we support our faculty as they move to this transition, but then also prepare for a coming back? Because I think it is going to happen. I'm an optimist, right? So I feel like we'll eventually come back to our classrooms and be back, face-to-face with our students. And so what is that going to look like a year from now when we're back face-to-face with our students? And how can we prepare ourselves for that? So
last question here, truly last question, Chauncey. You've shared with us an inspirational story about the path that led you to Valley and everything that you've done to date. And if a student's listening to this podcast and they have aspirations of becoming a professor, a faculty member in the music department, what advice would you give that student? What steps should they take? Do they follow your path? Is there lessons that you've learned along the way where you do things differently? How would you answer that question?
One thing I would certainly tell them is to don't give up. I tell my students about this in general in music, but not just about, let's say, becoming a music faculty member, but just in general. But I think it's true of if you're going to pursue teaching in music, especially like in an institutional level. A lot of musicians teach private lessons, but do you want to teach as a professor? That's a different sort of gig. And so don't give up. And the metaphor I'm always using is a steamroller. Just think of yourself as a steamroller, just crushing everything, every obstacle, every problem, every issue, every doubt in your path. Just keep moving forward. Don't stop. But I'm not sure that I would do anything differently. I mentioned earlier, like throughout my education, I've gone off on these various tangents. Some people might say to me, well, it took you 8 years to get your bachelor's degree or 10 years to get your bachelor's degree. That's a problem. I don't really see that as a problem because along the way, I gained a lot of knowledge that helps me teach my classes better now. I can, into the theory discussion, I can bring historical elements. I can bring technological elements. Those are all really important to my background. So I don't think I would change anything. So I just advise them to keep moving forward towards your goal. However you see the best way to pursue it, just keep pushing at it.
I love your metaphor of the steamroller, man. I'm stealing that one. That's great.
Keep that way. I love it.
Chauncey, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you? If a student wants to follow up with you, is it your email address? Do they find you on the music website, or what do you recommend?
Email address is the best way. I tend to be most connected to my email. So do you want me to give my address? Is that?
Sure.
Okay. So it's MADDRECM@lavc.edu.
Chauncey, thank you so much for spending time with us and taking us through the journey that got you to Valley College and where you're at now. And as I said before, I hope we can follow up and have a part two and talk about, you know, next steps at Valley College, the future, what it holds. There's a lot to dig into.
Sure. You're welcome. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both.